Here we go. Back to talk more New Deal. Last time we hit what are, to me, the most interesting and major issues, and that was the National Industrial Recovery Act and the National Recovery Administration and the economic rationales behind it, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, so the policy toward agriculture, some of the public works stuff we looked at as well, and the political nature of some of that, and so on and so forth. So we did a lot of the key programs. So we're going to continue along in that vein tonight. And we begin with labor, discussing labor unions and all that stuff. And in order to talk about the changes that are made during the 1930s, which are very substantial ones in American labor law, we want to explain what was labor law like before the changes came? What type of labor regime was being overturned in the 1930s? That's what we start with here. And I've talked a bit about this, and I have a chapter in my 33 Questions book, which basically covers this kind of material. But basically, if you had to sum it up, it would basically be that prior to 1932, when Hoover was still in office, basically you could summarize it as freedom of contract and freedom of association. So a worker is free to reject or to accept any offer of compensation that's made to him. And likewise, employers were free to accept or reject any offer that workers themselves make. And so an employee, if he's unsatisfied with his employer's terms, well, he can withhold his labor services. He is free to do that. He's the self-owner. And so a group of workers jointly exercising this right were free to do so. But because we're talking about freedom of contract and association, that means that if you have some type of grievance with your employer, that cannot justify and cannot make licit the forcible exclusion of those who want to work or do business with your employer with whom you're having a dispute. So strikers could strike. They could, you know, they could have one person or a small group of people standing there with a sign making clear what their position was. But they could not blockade a firm. That was a violation of private property rights. They couldn't prevent consumers from entering a struck firm. They couldn't prevent suppliers from making deliveries. And now on the employer's part, he's presumed to be the owner of private property. Sorry about that. You guys see the freeze before I see it. And so I see freeze and I think, no, people, don't worry. I'm not frozen. No, don't worry. Yeah, I'm frozen. All right, anyway, so we're saying that the plant owner owns private properties, is his property. He can invite anybody he wants to, but he can exclude anybody he wants to, including somebody who expects him to allow him to go in there and agitate his employees to bring about unionization. He certainly does not have to permit this, much less does he have to provide some space for them to have their little meeting. No, it's his property. If he doesn't want it to take place, it doesn't take place. Now, unions, sometimes when you hear about labor law prior to 1932, you hear a real caricature that unions were against the law or something, and then brave people changed everything. But that's not the case. Unions were not illegal per se. It's that unions were not allowed to engage in violence or to threaten violence or to interfere with the rights of other workers or of employers. And so, so that's why when people say, well, that made, labor unions were illegal. Well, yeah, coercive labor unions were illegal, but then that just gives the game away, doesn't it? That reveals that really the nature of a union is such that it is going to engage in this type of behavior. I think it was Henry George who said that, that imagining a labor union that uses moral suasion alone is you're about as likely to come across one as you are to come across a tiger who lives on oranges. Okay, let's move on. Okay, I have a lengthy quotation here that's very, very useful in summing up what labor law was like in the 19th century and into the early 20th century. And it's spelled out very clearly in this New York case of People versus Fisher. So it involved an attempt by a union to prevent Pennock, an independent bootmaker, from underselling them. And now listen to this. This explains exactly what I'm trying to say. The man who owns an article of trade or commerce is not obliged to sell it for any particular price, nor is the mechanic obliged to labor for any particular price. He may say that he will not make coarse boots for less than $1 per pair, but he has no right to say that no other mechanic shall make them for less. If one individual does not possess such a right over the conduct of another, no number of individuals can possess such a right. All combinations, therefore, to effect such an object are injurious not only to the individual particularly oppressed, but to the public at large. It may be that Pennock, from greater industry or greater skill, made more profit by making boots at 75 cents per pair than the defendants at a dollar. He had a right to work for what he pleased. His employer had a right to employ him for such a price as they could agree upon. The interference of the defendants was unlawful. Its tendency is not only to individual oppression, but to public inconvenience and embarrassment. Now, before going on, by the way, I just remembered a little housekeeping point. I believe this may be a quiz week. My memory is not so good these days, but if it is, I just want you to know that I am going to continue the thing where I give you the questions on a Tuesday, and I open it up by the Thursday. And so I am going to continue to give the extended deadline. It would basically be like a week, and it'll state there clearly on the quiz what the deadline is, but I was being much too parsimonious in the past, and I want to let you guys enjoy your weekends and not be cursing my name. I mean, I like being liked, basically. That's my big weakness. All right. Well, what I was saying was that I assigned you an article this week from years ago by Morgan Reynolds. And Reynolds served as the chief economist in the U.S. Department of Labor from 2001 to 2002 and is one of the great authorities we have on the history of labor law and labor union history. In fact, he wrote a long essay for LouRockwell.com on the history of labor unions in the U.S., very much worth reading. And in fact, at the break, maybe I'll dig that up because it's just a good resource to have, Reynolds on unions. But anyway, he goes through and gives you all the nitpicky details here. But okay, so the Norris LaGuardia Act is the first of these key changes to the law. So first thing is making yellow dog contracts unenforceable in the courts. Now, just off the top here, is there anybody who, and I don't mean to put you on the spot because I know you're all busy and if you haven't read the stuff, my feelings will not be hurt, but do people remember what a yellow dog contract is or know what a yellow dog contract is? Does anybody know? I'm going to have a glass of water while you think it over. Good, Kevin. Good work. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yellow dog. I don't know. It sounds like it has something to do with urine or something. But no, that's right. It's a contract that an employee would sign in which he would pledge that as long as he's employed there, he will not join a union or work for unionization. So those contracts are now made unenforceable in the courts. So they're not. You can still have them, but the courts aren't going to back you up on them. Now, one of the interesting things about that Reynolds article is that, of course, we assume that the initiative for yellow dog contracts must have come from employers who just want to prevent the unionization of their plant or whatever. But Reynolds shows that, number one, employees themselves sometimes preferred employment in which such contracts were required, and Such contracts also, he says, added nothing to the acknowledged legal right of employers to discharge workers for any reason, including union activity. But nevertheless, by the way, the reason that an employee might want a contract like this is that there are a lot of employees who felt like union agitation and the prospect of strikes and long periods of time without compensation were not made up for by the whatever union gains were able to be brought about, that they would rather just have the stability, the wage rate that's being offered and the stability, rather than dealing with the union and paying the dues and you know, wondering what it's going to do next. It exempted labor unions from prosecution under the Sherman Antitrust Act. Well, that's significant because, of course, the Sherman Antitrust Act talks about the Sherman Antitrust Act was an anti-monopoly measure. And one of the ways that a mainstream economist determines that a monopoly is in existence or that an attempt at monopolization is taking place is that the alleged monopolist reduces his output in the hope of increasing the price he gets, increasing his income, increasing his net, his overall income. Well, what are labor unions basically doing if not that? They are trying to reduce the amount of labor in a particular industry so that their own members, who will now be in an industry that has an artificial shortage of labor, will enjoy higher wages. Well, isn't that operating in exactly this way, that you're restricting your output, in this case of labor, in order to increase your income? Well, in case there was any concern about this, that is removed by the Norris LaGuardia Act. And also restricted federal courts from issuing injunctions against unions. An injunction was a court order demanding that a union cease strike activity pending a court appearance. Oh, well, in fact, here it is. I forgot I quoted Reynolds. An injunction temporarily restrained union actions pending a trial. And this explains the intense union campaign against its use in labor disputes, because once violence-ridden strikes were enjoined for a few days, they were difficult to revive, reorganize, and rekindle. Now, Sylvester Petro, who wrote a lot of scholarly articles and studies, and he wrote a book called The Labor Policy of a Free Society. He dedicated it to Ludwig von Mises, and I've got it around here somewhere, but bothered to look, instead of just going on, sorry for sitting like this, it's more comfortable, instead of just going on anecdotal evidence or whatever, he actually bothered to look. And he found that during the critical period from 1888 to 1932, injunctions had been exceedingly rare. So federal injunctions were issued in not even 1% of work stoppages, while state injunctions were issued in less than 2% of all work stoppages. So this was not, in fact, some horrendous ordeal going on. And when we look at those few injunctions that did take place, and Petro and others have investigated this, they were not being issued for the purpose of stopping labor unionism per se. It was always with an eye to stopping violence that was taking place. Okay, then now we get to the New Deal problem. Okay, right here, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. This is going to build upon the labor provisions that had been included in the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933. But the National Industrial Recovery Act was declared unconstitutional. So everything went, including the labor provisions of it. They were all gone. So this came along and basically filled the gap and instituted a great many changes. So this is commonly known as the Wagner Act. And it establishes something called the principle of what's called exclusive representation. So if most workers in a particular firm or a plant or whatever decide they want to unionize, then that union represents every worker, even those workers that had voted not to unionize or had voted not to have that particular union. Well, anyway, what I was just saying is that in two weeks from now, we're going to be talking about, you know, when I keep saying these various acts are struck down as unconstitutional, we're going to be talking about that, why they were struck down, what the arguments were. But now, how do they justify making people pay, you know, union dues for a union they voted against? Like, I mean, how do you justify that type of compulsion? And basically the answer is, well, look, the union is acting on behalf of all the workers. I mean, if the union is able to bring about an improvement in working conditions or higher wages or some such thing, then everybody benefits. So nobody should be allowed to be a free rider. Everybody should have to contribute union dues. That was the argument. But the problem with this argument is that the argument takes for granted exclusive representation, that everybody has to be represented by a particular union. What if they didn't have that system? So if workers were not required to be represented by a monopoly union in the first place, this objection about free riding wouldn't hold. The people who didn't want to be represented or didn't want to be represented by that union would simply choose not to be represented in the union's negotiations with the employer. And so they would not be free riders on union activity. The union would win concessions for its members and not for them. Okay. It's interesting to note that just 1 year before he signed the Wagner Act into law, Roosevelt himself had publicly opposed the principle of exclusive representation. So to avoid a strike by the UAW, the United Auto Workers, in 1934, a strike that he feared was going to shut down the whole auto industry, FDR intervened and settled it on the basis of proportional representation. So the United Auto Workers would represent only its own voluntary members and would not be the exclusive bargaining agent for all industry workers. And in fact, FDR even said in a radio broadcast that proportional representation, which he used in that case, was the only organizational principle for labor unionism that was compatible with the American commitment to liberty. In fact, the idea of exclusive representation, we take it for granted because we, you know, this is the system we live in. We see it all the time. But this is actually a relatively uncommon feature of labor management relations. And in fact, the only other democratic country that mandates exclusive representation is Canada. And Canada basically learned the principle from the United States. Okay, now once a majority of workers the way of faith with unions that were established by a majority of workers. Well, what does that mean? What does in good faith mean? Well, don't worry. The National Labor Relations Board will determine whether an employer has bargained in good faith. The Wagner Act made it an unfair labor practice for employers to attempt to influence their employees' decision whether to unionize or not. Now, this is interesting. Now, I think later on in the late 1940s, this was modified because this was viewed as an infringement on free speech. And obviously, they have to be able to say what they want. And my wife and I, just last night, we've become fans of the show The Office. We're a little latecomers to the show. We were watching season two last night. I was just lazy in bed last night watching one episode after the other of The Office. And there is an episode in which Michael goes down to the warehouse, and he's causing such problems, and they're so upset with him that they actually get into a frenzy where they begin talking about unionizing. And he doesn't know what to do, so he brings down I don't remember that woman's name, it was on periodically, and she comes down and says to them, You know what happened the last time? There was unionization. You know, when this plant over here unionized, everybody lost their jobs. They shifted the resources everywhere else. If that's what you want to do, just go into it with your eyes open. And I thought to myself, whoa, that would not have been allowed under the Wagner Act. And I thought, what a dork, right? But they did change that years later, simply because of the free speech thing. Like, presumably, you should be allowed to open your mouth and say things on your own property. So, okay. Yeah, I know there's a – I'll just say, President, I know there's a British version. We keep seeing that in the credits, but I don't get – it seems like such an American show. Like, it seems so – it seems – the characters are just perfect, weird Americans. So, anyway, all right, that's another question. We'll talk about The Office later. Okay, so employers then were required to let strangers use company property for the purpose of persuading employees to unionize. And then the economic rationale – behind a lot of this was also, it wasn't just that laborers were presumed to operate under a kind of an inequality of bargaining power, right? Because they're laborers, if they don't have a job, they'll starve, and so the employers know that, and so they can hold out. That wasn't the only argument. The other argument is this underconsumptionist thing, that we need employees to just have more let me read this passage first. The inequality of bargaining power between employees who do not possess full freedom of association or actual liberty of contract and employers who are organized in the corporate or other forms of ownership association substantially burdens and affects the flow of commerce and tends to aggravate recurrent business depressions by depressing wage rates and the purchasing power of wage earners in industry. So there you go again, purchasing power. We've got to bid wage rates up. We don't consider the possibility that this will disemploy people and so on. But there you go. Okay. What else did I want to say about this? Inequality of bargaining power. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole thing. I mean, we could talk also about answering this inequality of bargaining power argument. But that's not... labor law and how this is one of the first really high profile examples of its application. What is that quote from? Hold on, let's go back. Let's see. I don't remember, but I'll find out. Inequality of bargaining power. I will find out. I don't remember where I got that quotation from. Normally I put the person's name. Where the heck did that quotation, where did underconsumption? Yeah, I actually don't know, but I'll do a Google search for the phrase and see if it comes up. Oh, good. Okay, you found it. Okay, good. Okay, thanks. I have no idea where I got that. Okay. All right, so late 1936, big strike, UAW strike primarily against GM. And the UAW shuts down GM's plant in Flint, Michigan for 6 weeks. And it seizes control of company property, fired at anyone who tried to send them away, and would not allow any work to be done. And so the governor of Michigan and the president declined to support the removal of the strikers from company property. Now, this would have just been assumed to be the correct policy in the past, that the property belongs to the property owner. And if you're going to be sitting there engaging in this type of behavior, he can physically remove you. Not anymore. So Alfred Sloan, the GM president, was kind of in the mood to make some cars. So he's demanding that, this can't possibly mean. I mean, the new law doesn't say anything about the workers have the right to do all the things they're doing. But the issue is that the balance of power had shifted. It seemed to Sloan that surely the unions couldn't possibly have a legal leg to stand on doing what they're doing. So he's invited by the Secretary of Labor to negotiate with John L. Lewis, the very famous head of the UAW, and Sloan refused. He said, "We cannot see our way clear to accept the invitation to negotiate further with the union while its representatives continue to hold our plant unlawful." Because, of course, there is nothing in any of these laws that says that the workers can do this. But nobody will, the thing is, nobody will do anything about it. So de facto, they do have the right to do it. And so Sloan gets no support for his position and was forced to capitulate in early 1937. So I mention that because it is an illustrative case. Well, I mean, it's the usual, I mean, you know, it's the usual grievances, nothing particularly unusual here. I mean, just, you know, we want higher wages. It wasn't like today when they want a masseuse. That actually was one of the demands. They wanted massages during the day. I think this was more your customary thing. Okay, then we get the first minimum wage law in 1938. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that a Rothbardian historian will dig a little bit deeper into than the typical historian. Typical historian will say, wonderful, this is a great step forward for mankind. It's great. It means less exploitation of people by private firms and so on. But it may – oh, sorry. I forgot. You guys are hearing I'm crushing a water bottle. All right. But what we want to look at here is, might there be some interest groups at work here? Might this be something other than a heartwarming sense of duty toward the working class or the poor? And what we find is that a major mover behind the law was, surprise, surprise, the high-wage New England textile industry, which is concerned about low-wage labor in the South as a source of competition. So the Massachusetts Governor Charles Hurley says that Congress has got to pass a law to increase Southern wage rates so that, quote, Massachusetts would have equal competition with other sections of the country, thus affording labor and industry of Massachusetts some degree of assurance that our present industries will not move out of the state. Obviously, Charles Hurley's brain lacks that little bitty part that tells you this is something you say out loud and this is something you just say secretly in your own head. We also have Davis Bacon is another example. I mean, that's obviously has obviously discriminatory intent. U.S. Congressman Sam McReynolds of Tennessee says, Northern industries are trying to stop the progress of the South, and they feel if they can pass this minimum wage bill, it will really be a tariff against Southern goods. And you can find other quotations to this effect in ensuing decades. I think there are a couple you can find in the 1960s as well. I said the loud part soft and the soft part loud. I remember that. Okay, so that's another aspect of the New Deal, the introduction of the minimum wage. Now, you notice, by the way, that every once in a while they vote to increase the minimum wage or – you know, because they'll say, well, the minimum wage has fallen behind inflation, so we've got to increase the minimum wage, whatever. Why didn't they just index the minimum wage to inflation to start with? And the answer is that that wouldn't have been any fun, because now this means that, like, every few years they can trump it up as a giant issue and basically persuade the economically less astute that they're wonderful heroes and everything. And so this allows it to become a high-profile issue on a regular basis instead of just a one-shot deal. They get to keep bringing this up over and over and over and over. Okay, all right, now Social Security. Okay, I want to jump off a bridge talking about Social Security, but here we are. Well, I have a couple of juicy quotations. Carolyn Weaver is a researcher who's written on Social Security. Obviously, we know, I mean, those of you who certainly are Americans, you know what Social Security is. I mean, most of you have to pay into it. And you have a Social Security card. So we all know it's by and large an old age program and the idea is you pay into it and then later on you get some money and all that when you retire. Okay, well, Carolyn Weaver says, arguing that, in fact, more or less people were actually doing okay, contrary to what we've been led to believe. She writes, even among the most industrial states, the vast majority of the elderly were dependent on neither organized private or public charity or the almshouse. Instead, they were self-supporting or supported by families and friends. According to the findings of the New York Commission on Old Age Security, for example, out of the estimated 603,700 persons over 65 residing in the state in 1929, nearly 90% were either self-supporting or voluntarily provided for by friends and families. Less than 4% of the state's elderly were found to be dependent on organized private charity or public assistance. Let's also remember, by the way, that the very idea of retirement was just not that common in the first place. So if we're wondering, well, what did people do before? Well, mostly they died. I mean, the average life expectancy was such that people didn't live as long as they do now. And so that was one issue. Okay, I'm going to start just with Jim Powell. Okay. Poverty among the elderly appeared to be caused mainly by low earnings during working years, which made it tough to accumulate savings. This problem lessened with the rising level of prosperity and the dramatic growth of private insurance, annuities, and pensions geared to low-income workers. Okay, so here are the key provisions. You have a 2% payroll tax on the first $3,000 of income. So right now, I think the payroll tax with Social Security is on the first, it's something like the first $106,000of income. I think it's 106, that's somewhere like that. And I think the tax on Social Security, the Social Security tax now, what is it exactly now? 106,800. Okay. What's the exact rate? Because I always get it as one big, because I have to pay self-employment tax. 7.65%. Okay. All right. Well, basically, when you're self-employed like me, you pay double that because I'm also the employer. So I have to pay double that. Okay. Right. Okay. So it's 50%. Okay. But of course, you know, they frame it as half paid by the employee and half paid by the employer. But, you know, look, the employer has a certain amount set aside that he's prepared to pay for his workers. I mean, he doesn't care how they get paid. He doesn't care if he gives some of the money to the government, some to the worker, or if he gives it to the worker in the form of some fringe benefit and less cash or whatever combination the worker wants. He doesn't care. So likewise, all this is doing is just keeping money out of the hands of workers. All the money comes out of the workers' pocket, in effect. But, of course, this makes it more palatable to frame it this way. All right. So initially, various classes of workers were exempt. Some self-employed people, farmers were exempt. But they were gradually integrated into the program over the years. Revenues would provide for current retiree benefits, and any revenues over and above this amount would sit in an old age reserve account and be invested in government bonds. And Americans could begin collecting benefits as of January 1, 1942, if they had ceased all gainful activity and reached age 65. Well, by 1939, I don't know why I'm so restless today. Just been sitting in this chair all day long. Social Security had already been amended to become a pay-as-you-go system. So it's not a system whereby, you know, you put in money and they keep it and invest it for you and then you get it later. No, it's that the money's going to go to current retirees immediately, and then when you're a retiree, the current workers will pay you. But it's not like you are providing for your own thing. That's not what it is. Somebody mentioned Ponzi scheme. It's worth mentioning. I'm sure a lot of you, you know the name Peter Schiff, but I was very interested to listen to the program he had maybe 2 months ago. I don't know. Could it be that long? I don't know. But anyway, he had a program, and I think it was with a former Social Security actuary or somebody, some key person. And Schiff asked the guy, he's a guy who works for Social Security, he asked him, do you know what a Ponzi scheme is? And the guy said, yes, I do. And Schiff said, can you explain what's the difference between a Ponzi scheme and Social Security? And I'm not joking. The line went dead. The guy just said nothing. Silence. And, of course, silence is deadly in radio. So Schiff says, well, look, I'll give you the whole commercial break to think over your answer. And he came back. The guy still really had no answer. Okay, so various amendments were made to it over the years that expanded benefits and accelerated payouts. So now they're going to begin in 1940 instead of 1942. This is going to deplete the fund in the old age retirement account. So because of that, payouts for future workers would have to come from the tax receipts from current workers. They've already blown the money. Bennett Clark was a U.S. senator from Montana. This is very revealing. He offered an amendment that would allow people to opt out of the program if their own pensions offered more generous terms. Well, what could be more reasonable than that? Even with Democratic control of the Senate by a 2-to-1 margin, the Clark Amendment passed 51-35. FDR was adamantly opposed and threatened to veto the Clark Amendment, the whole bill, if the Clark Amendment were included, and it was removed during a House-Senate conference. Now, Social Security also had under-consumptionist motivations as well. We need to spread purchasing power around to keep the economy healthy. It's based on the idea that the Depression had been caused by a drop-off in consumer spending, when in fact consumer goods industries had done much less poorly than capital goods industries. Okay, now Social Security legislation is initially presented in 1935, and it talks all about insurance. This is an insurance program, and its supporters called it an insurance policy. And one of the reasons they went out of their way to call it an insurance policy was that the insurance industry came out of the Great Depression with an excellent reputation because, by and large, they had remained solvent. They had made good on their obligations. And so to call something insurance was to call to people's minds the image of a really robust and strong industry, even during the most difficult times. So insurance, 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 insurance. But then the fear was, what if the Supreme Court declares the federal government has no authority to establish an insurance program? So then suddenly they have to start calling it not insurance. It's not insurance. It's not insurance. It's not insurance. I don't know why we said that in the first place. Not insurance. So what they did was the taxing and benefit portions of the program were made separate with no express link between them. So there's a tax. And you get paid benefits, but it's not like the tax yields a little fund from which your benefits come. That would then it might look too much like some type of insurance thing. So we have to make it unclear. So Thomas Elliott, who was the legislative draftsman of the first Social Security bill, later admitted that he deliberately made the bill confusing. Now, Andrew Aschenbaum, who is the author of a book called Social Security Visions and Revisions, says this: lest the court take judicial notice of the way officials were trying to sell the program, administrators believed it was imperative to keep the language sufficiently opaque. So understand, they're trying to make this as unclear as they possibly can. You're going to have to pass this bill to see, find out what's in it. All right, so finally the program seems to be safe from constitutional challenge. So then supporters go back to saying, it's an insurance program, it's insurance, insurance, insurance. One in which the Social Security tax was constituted up in, like an insurance premium that guaranteed you an absolute right to receive benefits in old age. So this way, it would not be disdained as a mere welfare program. It's not welfare, they would say. You're paying in, and it's on those grounds that you are taking out. But, the case of Fleming versus Nestor. Ephraim Nestor, born in Bulgaria, had been deported from the U.S. in 1956 because of his earlier communist activities. The federal government denies him his Social Security benefits, and there had been amendments to the Social Security Act in 1954 that said that anybody who's deported for criminal activity loses his Social Security benefits. But Nestor sued and said, now, wait a minute, no, that's unconstitutional because from the beginning, you're violating the provisions of the Social Security Act. Because from the beginning, weren't you telling us all along that this is an insurance policy that gives you an absolute right to benefits. He says, throughout this, the history of the Social Security Act, old age insurance benefits have been referred to as a right of the recipient, which he has earned and paid for. But listen to what the federal government's legal brief says about Social Security. It is the exact opposite of what they told people it was all about in the 1930s, and pretty much the opposite of what many people think it's all about today. The government says Social Security is in no sense a federally administered insurance program. You know, where'd you ever get that idea? In which each worker pays premiums over the years and acquires at retirement an indefeasible right to receive for life a fixed monthly benefit, irrespective of the conditions which Congress has chosen to impose from time to time. The contribution exacted under the Social Security plan from an employee is a true tax. It is not comparable to a premium under a policy of insurance promising the payment of an annuity commencing at a designated age. That is unbelievable. That's just incredible. All right, let's move on. All right, taxes. Great. All right, well, under Hoover, we already saw we had the Revenue Act of 1932, and that introduced all these excise taxes that were designed as emergency measures, cars and tires and gasoline and toiletries and electric energy and luxury items and bank checks and telephone and telegraph messages. Well, for the most part, these emergency excises were retained or even increased throughout the 1930s. Now, this is very odd for us because we think in terms of the income tax as really being the key source of federal revenue. But for the first 4 years of FDR's presidency, it was excise tax revenue that was the key. It was greater than the revenue coming from income taxes and corporate taxes combined. Okay. So then we get the Revenue Act of 1935. The top marginal income tax rate hits 79%, and it increases estate, gift, and corporate taxes. FDR's Attorney General Homer Cummings says, "I cannot understand why it is immoral to stop people from becoming rich." Walter Lippmann, who was a he was one of the founders of the New Republic magazine. He was a well-known commentator, prolific writer and author, and, you know, had by and large been at least a, you know, more or less a sympathizer, an erstwhile supporter of the New Deal. But he really began to grow sour. He soured on it as the years went by because he felt like it was directionless. It was maybe even interfering with the recovery. And he said that this tax bill reflected the absence. So in other words, this is not some right-wing extremist or whatever, libertarian speaking here. That's what makes it all the more interesting. He says the tax bill reflected the absence of any plan and the lack of intellectual effort, the work of tired brains relying on their wishes and their prejudices and throwing out casual suggestions which they are too hot and bothered to think about. The New Republic itself, again, not a free market publication, to put it mildly, says the whole conception behind the tax bill overlooks the fundamental fact that there is little point in trying to redistribute wealth as long as nothing is done to produce more than a fraction of the wealth we are equipped to create. Historian Gary Dean Best writes, "Previously, pro-Roosevelt newspapers, newspapermen, businessmen, and progressives abandoned him in large numbers over the tax bill, many of them not to return to the New Deal fold again. In large part, the defection resulted because the arguments put forth in defense of the bill were so quickly and easily discredited. And when these layers of argument were peeled away, nothing remained to justify the bill but prejudice, vindictiveness, and spite." Then we had an undistributed corporate profits tax imposed in 1936 and was repealed against FDR's will 3 years later. A company retaining 1% of net income would have 10% of it seized. A company retaining 70% of net income would have 73.91% taken. Ray Moley, who was an advisor to FDR, who broke with the president as the years went on. We just couldn't believe, because he was so demoralized by the consistently anti-business rhetoric of the president and his inner circle. He said, "I was impressed as never before by the utter lack of logic of the man, the scantiness of his precise knowledge of things that he was talking about, by the gross inaccuracies in his statements, by the almost pathological lack of sequence in his discussion, by the complete rectitude that he felt as to his own conduct, by the immense and growing egotism that came from his office, by his willingness to continue the excoriation of the press and business in order to get votes for himself, by his indifference to what effect the long-continued pursuit of these ends would have upon the civilization in which he was playing a part. In other words, the political habits of his mind were working full steam with the added influence of a swollen ego. Okay, I think we got through that quotation anyway, and if not, it's sitting there on the screen. I don't know why. We had a couple of freezes in the earlier hour, but it wasn't quite like this. Sorry about that. Let's see. Did we get to the end of this part here before I froze out? Because I saw somebody say, ouch, which I assumed to mean that you saw how bad this quotation is. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, just take a quick glance at this because it seems like it kind of went out at different times with different people. So at the end when he says, my deliberate impression is that he is dangerous in the extreme and I view the next 4 years with no inconsiderable apprehension, he's writing at the end of 1936. I didn't put that in, but it's 1936. Okay. And then meanwhile, state tax revenues doubled during the 1930s. So the presence of government is quite evident throughout the economy. Okay, just a quick note on the issue of the Tennessee Valley Authority. The purpose of this program was to bring electrification and inexpensive electricity and fertilizer to the Tennessee Valley. Well, the energy economist William Chandler did a study and found that economic growth in states bordering Tennessee, which did not get their power from the TVA, was as high or higher than in the Tennessee Valley. Tennessee and Georgia had virtually identical per capita incomes before the TVA. With the completion of ever more TVA dams into the 1940s, per capita income in Georgia began to surpass that of Tennessee and continued to do so for the next four decades through Chandler's day. And he writes, among the nine states of the southeastern United States, there has been essentially an inverse relationship between income per capita and the extent to which the state was served by TVA. Watershed counties in the seven TVA states, moreover, are poorer than the non-TVA counties in those states. And so why would that be? Well, Jim Powell writes, receiving TVA-subsidized electricity gave Tennessee Valley farmers an incentive to remain in agriculture. Throughout the Tennessee Valley, people left farming for manufacturing and later for service industries at a slower rate than was the case in the bordering states of Georgia, North Carolina, and Arkansas. People in these states moved more quickly into manufacturing and service sectors, which offered higher incomes. Moreover, with the non-TVA states industrializing faster and thus contributing to a growth in incomes, the market for electricity itself grew correspondingly larger, and so even the sale of electrical products wound up being greater in non-TVA states. Okay, so to conclude, this week and last week we looked at the basics of the New Deal. We've gone over industrial policy, agriculture, public works, labor relations, taxation, Social Security, and miscellaneous other features. Next week, we look at the 1930s economy overall, paying particular attention to economic performance under the New Deal regime, because there are, in fact, arguments on this subject from people who are, by and large, supporters of the New Deal. Now, our side of things will typically say, look, the unemployment statistics are terrible, and so on and on. So it just goes to show that the 1930s were not a good time. I'm going to show you next week that there is an argument on the other side that things were actually doing pretty well. And so I want to look at how do we resolve this. Certainly somebody has to be right, somebody has to be wrong in this debate. So how do we solve this? And so one of the things we're going to do, in fact, next week is actually read the text of a debate. Well, actually, it was a debate submitted in writing between Bob Murphy and an economic journalist on this issue. And then we will just decide. We'll take a little time for discussion. And, you know, who do we think makes the better argument and why? Are there any leftover arguments that are sort of left hanging? We'll address them. But that's really some significant stuff, because this is what you're going to have to talk about anytime people want you to assess the New Deal and whether it's a success or failure. They want the numbers, and we are going to go over the numbers, and you're going to have a lot of substantial information and ammunition under your belt. Okay. Did Bob Murphy and Krugman ever get their debate? No. But I think Bob intends – Bob has just had an extremely crushing professional schedule. But it is his intention to continue to push this into 2011. He's got some creative ideas up his sleeve. So I think, you know, we'll have some more fun with that. Okay. I guess that's it for the formal presentation. Let's take 10 minutes. Let's take until 5 minutes after the hour. 5 minutes after 10 p.m. Eastern time, and then we'll come back here. Before I go, I'm going to call up. I'm going to put the questions in a separate window here, so I can read them easily. In fact, I'm going to do that right now. Okay, let's see. Economic History 106. I forget if it's. I have two of these: my old one and this one. Come on. Nope, that's not it. Okay, I'm going to open up now. All right. Let's see. That's not what I wanted. I'm trying to just get the questions to come up. Come on. I don't know why I'm slow tonight here. And good, I got it in a separate window. That's good. Get this in another window. Move the screen with my face on it to over here. All right. All right, let's see. I have to quickly have a snack. I am so unbelievably hungry. I gotta go get like a fistful of pretzels and stuff them into my mouth. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. All right. So we're gonna do the questions. If you want to submit a question, then please submit it through there. And then later on, you know, I'll also resort to the chat room. Okay. Oh, I've got so much email. I can't possibly answer all this. I mean, I love mankind and everything, but I can't possibly answer all this. I just need to do one quick thing. Okay. All right. I think before – well, actually, no, I'll wait because maybe people have gone to get a snack or something. I'll wait till we come back. So somebody make sure and remind me. I just want to ask people – because I've got a few speaking engagements coming up, and I just want to see if anybody lives in the area or – not that I'm going to force you to come, but I just want to mention it. You know, what's funny is from my earlier class tonight, before it was time for it to get started. I had left the room, and apparently one of my kids came in the meantime, and, you know, came in here in front of the camera, you know, I guess was looking, she could see herself. So, and people said, oh, that was cute, we saw one of your kids, and I didn't know which one it was. So I went out to try to find out which one it was, and they all think they're in trouble. I'm saying, hey, which one of you was in here? And so they naturally they assume they're in trouble. I don't know. I have no idea who that could have been. So I don't know who that was. Yeah, on the 1921 thing, Professor Herbener has done, at Grove City College, has done some good stuff on it, but it's all private. He hasn't done anything with it. He needs to publish that stuff. That would really help. Okay. First question. I've once heard the argument from my history teacher that unemployment was declining until 1937 when FDR slowed government spending too early and unemployment went up by a few million. What is the reason for this spike in unemployment, or was there really a spike at all? Yeah, there was. That's actually referred to. What happened in 1937 and 1938 is sometimes called the depression within the depression. But that's actually, we are actually going to talk about that next week. You'll see there's a reading on the depression of 1937. For next week, and I'm going to go over what the causes were. I mean, I'll basically give you a little bit of a hint at it, but because of all this added impetus to labor unionism and strikes and the strength of labor unionism, real wages increased in 1 year by over 13%, and this was a huge shock to the business world and naturally had a depressing effect. So there is that. But we'll have more to say about it. I'm going to try to evaluate some of the competing claims, precisely the one that your teacher mentions, that, well, if the government stops spending, well, then naturally, you know, everything comes to an end, because obviously we know that no one else would spend if the government weren't there. We're going to look at the numbers. We're going to look at, see if that argument holds up. I think you probably know where I stand on that, but that's the most typical argument. Then there's an argument pertaining to Fed policy, and I'm going to evaluate that too. But it this episode does not prove what the interventionists wanted to prove. Although it is interesting, though, that they are basically implicitly conceding that the alleged recovery that they claim was happening in those years must have been phony. Because as soon as even the mildest retrenchment from government employment takes place, there's a huge crash. So by their own, if that's going to be their explanation, that the depression within the depression was caused by a decline in government spending and in government jobs, well, then aren't they admitting that after years and years and years of stimulus and propping up and whatever, they still haven't been able to produce any real jobs? Any job that could actually still, you know, hold their own in the absence of government spending? Okay, wouldn't proportional, so we'll talk about that next week. Wouldn't proportional representation with unions cause problems? For instance, union workers might be making $4 an hour more for the same job than a non-union employee working right next to them. How does that work? Well, if that were true, if the differential were that great, everybody would just go and join the first union, I think. I think probably the differential would not be that great. I think it would be great enough to that some people would want to join that union, but not so great that it could overcome all the misgivings of all those workers who feel like unionism can be more headaches than it is help. So that's what I suspect would happen. But you know, people can join whatever union they want. So if they felt like $4 extra an hour was worth, you know, whatever turmoil unionization would bring, then people would just join. Okay. Yeah, what does it actually mean in terms of contracts being bargained on in good faith? Does that mean the contract agreement has to be reached and an arbitrator has to be brought in if the two parties reach an impasse? Yeah, I mean, I don't exactly know what it means, and I don't think they exactly knew what it meant. They just knew that this is one of these phrases that they are, you know, that their National Labor Relations Board will be able to interpret however it wishes, basically. I mean, they will determine what that means. So it's necessarily subjective. And it just, you know, it's based on the government's assessment of a particular situation. which makes it all the harder. Given that there is no official definition of good faith, it makes it all the harder on the private sector to figure out what exactly it is they're supposed to be doing, or should they bother trying to assert their rights, or will asserting what they consider to be their rights or asserting their position vigorously be perceived as not bargaining in good faith? Does the NLRB step in and eventually force a contract? See, I don't follow labor disputes closely enough to actually know how that's worked out in practice, but I bet you some astute Google searches by Doug, I could dig some stuff up on that. What are your thoughts on alternatives to the Social Security system, such as personal retirement accounts, converting the system to an IRA or 401k, raising the retirement age, or getting rid of the system altogether? And what would be the Austrian free market alternative to Social Security? Do we even need a Social Security system in the first place, or is it out of date? This is a matter of opinion, really. I'm more or less in favor of any of these alternatives. I'm not so much in favor of a government-run alternative that involves putting some of the money in the stock market, because then that has got gigantic bailout of Wall Street written all over it. I mean, it's just got sirens and red lights and everything all over it for that. So I tend to avoid that. But, my feeling is that, at this point, people are not, they're not accustomed to the idea that they should be prepared for their retirement, or that they should have a family that can help them if they should need it as they get older. Like, this is, Americans feel like when they turn age 18, they have the natural right never to have to talk to their family again if they don't want to. So this is a tricky situation to try to overcome. But if we didn't have this cultural problem right now, my view would be that, as with everything, that you shouldn't, you can't use physical violence against peaceful people, even if it's for this or that great outcome. That basically this is what families are for, this is what civic groups are for, this is what proper planning is for. And yeah, of course people naturally fall through the cracks, but in a functioning market society, we would be wealthy enough to care for them and then some. But if you ask what my own opinion is that I want my money back, I will do with it, I will do good things with it, I'll take care of it. And I will take care of people who need help. And my wife and I do that already. Okay. Have there been any serious attempts by Congress to do away with Social Security? I don't know, not to do away. There have been attempts by Congress to modify it in various ways, like trying to increase the retirement age or increasing the taxes, which was done in 1983. That was how Reagan so-called saved Social Security. But, it's just unthinkable to imagine. I think Barry Goldwater was interested in making Social Security optional, just giving people a choice. And even that opened him up to charges of extremism and all the rest of it. So, yeah, that's the answer to your question. Next question. So from the lesson tonight, am I to understand that Social Security, as far as the government is concerned, is not insurance and guaranteed in any way? That is correct, because the wording of all the legislation makes clear that Congress may change the terms of it at any time. So they have made that clear. They are not obligated to pay you anything. Now, obviously, they're very unlikely to just suddenly stop and overnight pay you nothing. But the point is that if they want to change the retirement age, they can do that. If they want to change the taxes, they can do that. If they want to change the benefit levels, they can do that. If they want to, well, whatever, they can do all these things. They're not strictly speaking, they do not strictly speaking have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind Social Security payments, that is. But as I say, they're not going to just turn it to zero overnight, but they reserve the right to modify the program in these various ways. And it's interesting that if this were an insurance program, I think you would, that would be like a breach of the program if they started doing that. Okay, what do you think about the growing conflict between the private sector and government union employees that seems to be growing in this nation and dividing the nation? I work in a probably 80% unionized environment, and they are constantly complaining at work about people like us and how their rights are being taken away. Yeah, that's true. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of – oh, wait, am I frozen? Can everybody see me? Am I still here? Okay, everybody say I'm here. Okay, all right. I don't know the details of how all the various states' pension programs are funded. They're different in some states than in others, but in some states it will be a major tax liability, for example, to make good on a lot of these pension deals. And Tom DiLorenzo wrote a good article on public sector unions for Mises.org not long ago, in which he said that the government, the state governments have been in a bit of a tight spot with these public sector unions, because on the one hand, you know, you want the votes that the union members bring, but on the other hand, you don't want to pay them such high salaries that you alienate the votes of, you know, everybody else and you lose their votes. So what they've basically done is they have come up with this kind of middle-of-the-road solution whereby in the present they grant modest salary increases to the government union workers. But they pacify them and at the same time evade the ire of the taxpaying public by funding or at least promising very, very substantial pension programs. Now, that is a good thing from the government employee, government's own point of view, because years ago when they started doing this, they figured, well, these pension programs aren't going to come due for years and years and years and years. So, right, we can buy their votes today. We don't have to pay for them for years and years and years. Well, unfortunately, this is years and years and years. That's where we are now. So given that, it's not, their gripe is not going to be with free market thinkers. Their gripe is going to be with taxpayers who are simply not going to pay this. They are not going to pay it, particularly when they compare the salaries of these workers with their own salaries. Like if you compare the average salary of a government worker in Miami, it's like more than double the average salary of a private sector worker. So like no, sorry, nobody has a right to that. Okay, if artificially low interest rates create bubbles, where do you think the bubbles are being created right now, and what do you think will happen when the Fed begins to raise rates with now 3 months in a row of reported CPI increases? Well, I'm not really so good at questions like this. People think I would have to be because I wrote Meltdown, but I really always feel uncomfortable with questions like this. Well, artificially low interest rates can create bubbles. They don't have to, because you could also just have a very – like we have now, you have a very uncertain environment, and you know that could lead people simply not to do anything with the cheap money. You know, like you offer them low interest rates, they just don't want to take it. So therefore, you know, no spending, no bubble. So that could well be. It's just everything's flat, or that we still haven't completely deflated the other bubbles. Like housing, for example, could still have a major problem. You find all these astonishing statistics about what did I read the other day? Was it a quarter of all the houses in Florida are vacant? That's unbelievable. I've heard about a possible million house overhang on the market. Just the statistics are very bad on housing in a bunch of ways. So where are the bubbles being created? Well, a lot of people say that the Treasury is the new bubble. That could be. But right now, I don't see what – I don't know offhand what that is, because I don't follow, like, you know, commodities and stuff day by day the way an actual economist would. I'm an economic historian. I'm interested in what commodities were doing like 100 years ago. So I'm not so good at something like that. Let me refresh one more time, and then I'll turn to the chat window and see what's going on there. Okay. Oh, I do have another one. Okay, somebody's asking me about a book called Where Does the Money Go? And the answer is I've never read or heard of this book, so I'm afraid I can't comment on it. Okay, now let's shift over to the chat window. If you want to ask a New Deal question, by all means do that. If you want to ask any other kind of question, or I mean, it could be about anything, whatever it is you want to talk about, we have another... know, like half an hour. And obviously people can go anytime you want. You don't have to stay for this or for any of the questions. I mean, you do what you want to do. This is a very laissez-faire environment. So I can't believe I bought – you guys do not need to know this. I bought a new belt because my old belt was too big. I was getting too thin for my belt, so I bought a new belt. I said, all right, this is great, just the size I need. I'm already on the last hole of this belt, and it's still not tight enough. I need another belt. All right, you didn't need to know that. Did not need to know that. Oh, thanks for digging out. Is that Tom's article? That looks like Tom's article. Thanks for doing it. Okay, what's going on with you guys here? Yeah, I can't predict the future. As a historian, I can only predict the past. That's easy. Oh, thanks. Yeah, my article on the Fed will run tomorrow. I've got a funny article. Well, the article isn't funny, but there's this funny graphic they made because I was saying that I'm addressing a pro-Fed guy, you know, who was making fun of Ron Paul and, you know, saying that, you know, look, we had all these terrible things before the Fed. You know, it's the usual sorts of arguments. And I wanted to address them. And so I was saying that, you know, this guy's view is that, you know, since we've had the Fed, it's been all sunshine and lollipops. And so whoever does this on Mises, they got a photo of, you know, like the Fed. And then there's a sun with like sunglasses on and a smile. I think it's the sun like on the Raisin Bran box. And then it's like a whole field of lollipops in front of the Fed. That is great. Okay. Okay, how could FDR keep on winning elections when the economy continued to sink? They used spending to buy votes. Yeah, that was kind of what I was driving at with some of those quotations from last week where politicians were saying, look, you know, if you're walking around with this much money in your pocket and you lose, there's something wrong with you. A lot of people were commenting on how this was the first example of how patronage was really beginning to be used as a way of buying votes. But I think you combine it with that and that, you know, the Republican alternative was not particularly attractive. It was very much a Me Too platform, very uninspiring. And the sense that, well, he is doing something. You know, we got to do something. One thing FDR. Yeah, Lee's question, I don't know. I should know more about that. But on the other hand, I know that, and I've got a huge number of books on. I'm very interested in Israel, the Middle East, all that stuff. And it's not just that FDR, you know, didn't want to allow Jews into the U.S., which was bad enough, but it's also that Zionist leaders didn't want them in the U.S. either. That Jewish refugees should not be given that choice, so that therefore they would have to go to Palestine. We need warm bodies in Palestine. I want to just skip ahead for a minute because I want to say thank you to Richard. That's very, very inspiring to say that. Thank you very much. That's really, really great. By Casey, do you mean Gerard Casey? Which Casey do you have in mind? I'm embarrassed if I'm missing somebody, but thank you very much. Oh, Doug Casey. Okay, yeah. Oh, well, that's really very, very interesting. You should write about that. People would love to read that, and it could inspire other people. You really should consider writing about that. If I were Walter Block, I would... Who portrays, he always says that he is the Jewish mother of the Austro-Libertarian movement. That's why he always says, all right, Tom, it's your Jewish mother writing to you. And I'm telling you, you've got to write this up because I'll send out some email to five people and he'll say, what are you sending this out to five people for? Submit it as an article. Okay, all right, let me go back though. I have a few other questions that were back here that look kind of interesting. What percentage of current legislation do you think came out of the Depression era? Well, I think it might be more better question be what percent of the current budget is spent on programs that come out of the Depression era, and I wouldn't know the answer to either one of them. But because I think actually a lot of the A lot of the current spending really comes out of the Great Society of the 1960s. I'm thinking about recent public schooling. They'll teach students how to make money. How to get rid of public schools is so ruining productivity. Well, to deal with getting public schools, you have to have a really persuasive answer to the what happens to the poor children. Right now, I'll tell you what happens to the poor children. They get terrorized all day in gang-infested schools. They lose whatever ambition they ever had to do anything. Then they get sent out with a meaningless piece of paper. And meanwhile, they have blown 12 years of their lives. That's what happens to the poor right now. But you need some kind of good answer to that. I'm not saying there isn't one. I think there is. But it needs to be articulated very, very effectively. I mean, public schools are like the center of all the little micro-patriotisms that exist in every town in America and around which all kinds of social functions and sporting events are organized. And for you to say we've got to get rid of this is going to be very, very hard for a lot of people to accept. I'm not saying you shouldn't say it, but it's just it's so ingrained that it's just very, very hard. So I don't think we think in terms of how do we get rid of the whole thing. We think one at a time. You know, each get your kid out of the thing. That's where you start, one at a time. Okay. Yeah, so I'm sure there have been studies of the effects of Social Security on the economy. I don't know who's done them, but surely they must have been done, but I'm not familiar with them. You could ask that at the Mises.com. Instead of Mises.org, go to Mises.com. There is there are discussion forums there that are the best-kept secret at Mises, Mises.org. But the quickest way to get there is by going to Mises.com. You post a question like that there, and you'll get great responses very quickly. I haven't read John Taylor Gatto. I'm sympathetic to him. I understand that some of his writing about the motivations behind the public school system are somewhat speculative. I mean, you can't strictly prove that they wanted to train a bunch of people who would be willing to be cogs in a machine and things like that. But he's iconoclastic, and I respect that. Okay, I don't actually address public schools and rollback mainly because I was dealing with federal expenditures. So I talk about federal education programs. I was really just going after the U.S. government. We'll do the states next, but I wanted to start with the federal government. Okay. In what part? I don't think the requirement to send children to school is in the state constitutions. I assume it's just some piece of legislation. Now, how they can justify doing it is a separate question. I don't know where that comes from. Okay. Yeah, Lee, that is like one of the best comments I've ever gotten here at the Mises Academy about spreading by example rather than doctrine. Yeah, that's right. I mean, some people are persuaded by doctrine. And certainly, like with libertarianism, I was like, I mean, I just thought it all made sense, and it's a great, you know, self-contained logical system. I love it. But we have to show that, you know, we can do all the things that people fear are not doable or would not be done, and that we not only can we do them, here we are doing them. We have in fact done them. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We got definitely. Although, you know, what's interesting is, I mean, that Khan Academy is just a stuff. Okay, I think you were frozen during that? That's too bad. All right, let's see. What do you think of the anti-collective bargaining situation that was happening in Wisconsin? I can't take the Walter Block position on this, and I love Walter. I mean, seriously, I would cut off my right arm for that guy. But now, but at the same time, I would like to see a more equitable reduction of state expenditures. And I don't mean that in the left wing sense. I mean cut. I mean make more cuts so that it seems more equal. But I haven't. I mean, I've read that the pension programs for these employees are not underfunded, and there is no taxpayer liability involved. I don't know the details because I never looked into it. Yeah, no, you're right about – Lee is right again. I mean, yeah, we need benefactors who will endow institutions. That's what we need. We don't need another free market organization. We are lousy with those. We don't need another newsletter. We don't need another magazine. We don't need another podcast. We need what you're saying. We need institutions. In other words, like educational institutions primarily. Okay. Oh, in terms of the red and blue, no, that's just entirely an arbitrary convention of USA Today. So there is no real reason for it. Oh, I was talking about the Khan Academy. Yeah, the Khan Academy, I hope you guys have heard of this. But, I mean, this guy is unbelievable. I mean, he's teaching all of mathematics from the most elementary up through advanced calculus for free, online, for free, in thousands of videos. You can just watch them for free. So it's going to get harder and harder to say, well, gee, how would anybody ever be educated? Well, gee, you could be educated for free. You know, hello? Okay. What is the Walter Block situation? Oh, Walter kind of takes the view, you know, a pox on both their houses. So he actually, I don't know. I can't do justice to his position, but he was not cheering on the governor of Wisconsin going after the government unions. But I can't do justice to his position, and I'm going to make it sound dumb, and I don't want to do that. So better that you just look up his article archive on lewrockwell.com if you're interested. Yeah, I would love to I want to see some recordings, some videos of Walter's recent speeches. Okay. Oh, Khan. Yeah, oh, there you go. So you already did that. Good. Are there some free courses on Mises Academy? I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, I've got my own little project that's it's going to be different from Mises Academy. The delivery is be different. And, I'm not going to cover the most of the same things either. But I've got kind of a cheap, you know, the cheapskates way to learn some other topics anyway, coming out later this year. I didn't mean to suggest you were a cheapskate. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. You can get all these audios. You can get all that stuff for free, absolutely. I mean, what Mises is giving away for free is like the equivalent of 1,000 courses. Is what the Gary North stuff? Oh, and my speaking engagements. Let's see. Well, Wednesday, so 2 days from now, I'll be in Flagstaff, Arizona, at Northern Arizona University. Then April 13th, I will be at Minnesota State University. And April 16th, I will be in Austin, Texas. Do any of you live anywhere? Like, you don't have to come hear me. I'm just curious to know. Anybody lives in these areas? Anybody live near any of those places? Oh, that's good. Okay. In Austin, that's good. I'm actually driving my car down there, which is going to be a long drive, but it's better than dealing with a plane. Phoenix. Okay. Well, Flagstaff's a little bit of a haul from Phoenix, unfortunately. Yeah, wasn't I there recently? I was at Grand Canyon University last year. Oh, that's very, very nice. Thank you. Thank you. That's going to be fun. Oh, that's good. Okay, yeah, we're going to have a good time in Austin. Kevin Gutzman's going to be there with me. I so rarely get to see him. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Let me answer this question here about Eugene Debs. Well, I mean, I don't have an opinion on it other than how awful it is. I can't imagine there is any other opinion. I mean, it's interesting that the hated president, Warren Harding, is the one who released him. And it was the great hero, Woodrow Wilson, who refused to allow him to be released. Yeah, and I included, Mari Polner and I included an excerpt from a Deb speech in our book, We Who Dared to Say No to War, which is our anti-war anthology. Where will I be the second weekend of August? Well, I don't think it's been cast in stone. It's either the first or the second weekend of August where I'll be at the Liberty Summit in Orlando. That's like my annual thing in August. Okay. Yeah, am I going to do another course picking up where this leaves off? In some format at some point. Right now I just have a lot going on where I'm trying to premiere something later this year, and I'm going to have to really turn my attention to that soon. So I won't be able to do it in the short run. Okay. And then June 4th, I was only talking about the next couple of weeks. June 4th and March 7th. Yeah, I've got, I'll be in California a couple times in May, finally. I haven't been there in a long time. I'll be in sort of near Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia, in early May. Also, I'll be in Bozeman, Montana, May 14th. Sorry, this is like a big Tom Woods ad. I'm sorry for that. And I will also be West Virginia. I'll be in West Virginia sometime probably in late June. No Pennsylvania, unfortunately. Is Pat, are you actually in Australia? Ah, okay. Yeah, my wife and I were thinking, someday, kids would have to be older, but we would love to make that trip someday. Let's see, will I be in the Kansas City area in the next few weeks? Well, I live in the Kansas City area, but broadly speaking, but I won't have any speaking engagements. I need to find a Steely Dan fan in Kansas City, because they're coming August 25th, and I have nobody to go with. My wife refuses to go. All right, hang on just a second. Let me just see. The private prisons thing, I don't know enough about how private prisons would work, but I don't think they would. I think what we have now when they're privatized is like a sick, twisted version of what they would look like in a free society. I don't think they would perform the functions that they perform now. I think they would be different kinds of places altogether. But that's not something I know much about. Anthony Gregory is a good guy on that, and Dan D'Amico is good on that. In fact, Dan D'Amico just did a YouTube with Jeff Tucker on private prisons. So that I would look at that. Okay, Maryland, I don't have anything coming up in Maryland. Iowa maybe, but I keep hearing from people they want to have me, but nothing has come of it so far. I've been to Connecticut a couple times the past year or two. And I do have, What I think of originalism as practiced by Justice Scalia. Well, I think Scalia is pretty good in some cases, but then other times he just surprises and disappoints me. So he just seems uneven to me. But in terms of his stated principles, I am sympathetic to originalism, yes. Okay. Yeah, I actually hate Reeling in the Years. Sorry. I like their jazzier stuff. Louisiana. I don't have anything in Louisiana. I don't have that much scheduled, actually, right now. Because now I'm coming up on the summer months. Those are typically kind of slow. I'll probably be in New York, though, New York City. There's a chance I'll be there September 10th. And chance I'll be in Nevada in September, and I'll definitely be in Houston and in South Carolina in October. Okay. Thoughts on the kingfish? Huey Long? South Carolina, I think it's going to be near, Furman University. Yeah, I think that there's an event that's planned near or at Furman University, which is in Greenville. Do it again is okay. Oh, we'll talk about, there's got to be a week where we talk about, maybe I forgot about it. Huh, I thought there was a week where we talked about, did you guys read about Huey Long this week? And you read about all these other people this week? Was that part of your reading? Okay, all right. I'll say a little bit about the next, because next week we don't have as much material to cover. So I will incorporate a little discussion of that. I wish I could remember where I saw it, but when Long describes his Share Our Wealth program, he's saying, you know, look, if we just taxed millionaires X amount, we could give everybody $5,000 and a free college education, whatever. And I remember, and I cannot for the life of me remember where I read it, but I remember reading somebody who actually calculated it out. And found out, well, actually, if we did that, we could give everybody, like, you know, $250 or something. Like, it was, like, not even in the ballpark what he was promising. Okay. Do I know anything about fountain pens? No, sorry, I don't. No, I didn't. All right, what else is on everybody's mind? Where are you guys going to be this year? We're going to be taking our annual beach trip. We're looking to spend June and July in Auburn, and we're going to take our annual trip to Florida, because we have a nice there's a place we go to overlooking the water, and it's very nice for relaxation. We'll be doing that, and before the year is out, I'm hoping to take my wife on a cruise. Which is not—it's not a matter of the money. It's a matter of you know—we have four kids, and I would like to have a few days just with her, and we have to arrange for that. Okay. All right. That's good. Well, my Montana trip makes 45 states that I have visited in my life, and by visited, I mean I've actually walked around there. So I will have been to 45 states by next month. Pretty darn good, I would say. Pretty good. I have not been, well, the two greatest states, of course, Alaska and Hawaii, I have not been to, I'm sorry to say. I haven't been to Wyoming, South Dakota, or Oregon, oddly enough, actually, one you might think I would have been to. So just those five. Oh, the Bumbaba t-shirt is at the Mises store. It's like a forest green color. Now, I cherish that thing. Oh, I was saying, well, I live in Topeka, so I live about an hour from Kansas City, but I don't have any engagements there. But the Nullify Now tour is 100% definitely coming to Kansas City later this year. It's probably later this year sometime. We don't know the exact date. But they had a fundraising thing using The Point, and it hit the tipping point, so it's going to happen. I have pictures of Jeff from the mid-90s when I was over at his house celebrating my birthday, actually. And he's wearing a regular necktie, but no, these days it's only a bow tie. I don't know why. Well, yeah, I haven't been able to look at it. I knew about that budget thing coming out. But I guess I'm just not interested in these 10-year plans. I want, what's your one-year plan? 10-year plans, you know, come on. I mean, how many of them have we ever in history actually lived up to? So what's the point in doing? But at least they're using the word trillion. That's at least something. Well, what do you guys think about the Bloomberg results? I mean, I think we found out some interesting stuff about foreign central banks, and that something seems very suspicious about what's going on in Libya. But yeah, and I've been reading just basically what Robert Wenzel has been saying about this stuff, and so, I mean, at least some of these institutions, you can just look and see that. This was This was not the emergency, everything's going to collapse. David Stockman has such a great piece on that, by the way, about how what a big scam it is that everything was going to collapse otherwise. But look, this is fantastic that all this is coming out, that the Fed is totally on the defensive. What was my experience like at how does one become a professor, especially if you're a retired professor? Okay, well, you become a professor, you got to just go through, you got to get your degree, and even if you want to teach at a 2-year school these days, you're going to need a PhD almost always. So you have to grind your way through that, and that might not be worth doing. Frankly, it's not worth it for everybody, but you got to just grit your teeth and put in your work. But my advice is, if you really want to be a professor, you here are the two things that you will wish someone had told you. But now you don't have to wish them, because I'm telling them to you right now. These are the two things everybody needs to know. Number one is, let's say you want to be a U.S. history professor. You go on the job market, you look at the job listings in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and you'll find they'll have listings for American historians, and they will also say outside field in, I don't know, Latin American history preferred, or outside field in East Asian history preferred. Start going through those ads right now and find what is the most common outside field they're asking for, and study it. Get some courses under your belt, because it's not going to do you any good looking at those job listings when you've already finished your studies and it's too late for you to have an outside field. Find out about that. No one's going to know about this. And by the way, nobody has those outside fields. I guarantee you almost nobody has a Latin American outside field, and that's in huge demand right now. If you do that, that will put you head and shoulders above the competition. Secondly, do not write articles for the internet or whatever, or spend your time doing that while you're in grad school. You don't have the time. What you need to spend your time doing is writing an article to be published in a scholarly journal. Maybe even two articles, presented at a conference even. This will put you ahead of the 50 zillion other brand new PhDs who will be going onto the job market. There'll be a million of them, but how many of them will have a major publication already to their credit? How many of those people will have that? So you have to subordinate absolutely everything to that project. That's what you need to do. Okay, let me go back here. Oh, then becoming a Mises adjunct scholar. Well, you have to distinguish yourself in some way, and the Institute will basically contact you and say, how'd you like to be listed as an adjunct scholar? You say, okay. Okay, let's see. Let's go back to these. Okay. What was your experience like at Columbia University? Well, I had a great experience as an undergraduate, but when I moved to New York to go to Columbia for grad school, I didn't have first couple of years, I was absolutely miserable there. I had nothing in common with anybody. And I'm the sort of person, by the way, I don't have to agree with somebody to be able to have a good time and laugh and tell jokes and whatever. I mean, almost none of my undergrad friends agreed with me on stuff, but we had a good time anyway. But Columbia was just, oh my, I don't know how to describe it. It was horrible. And then a couple of years into it, I moved into a dorm where I didn't have a lot of people, friends in common. But anyway, the point is, there were no sympathetic faculty at all. Like, the most right-wing member of the history department was Alan Brinkley, who was a left liberal. So he wasn't a Marxist, so that made him the most right-wing guy. So I just didn't have – plus, I was a young kid, and all the other grad students were married with children or married or whatever. And so, you know, I don't have anything in common with them. I learned a lot, and I had a very good PhD advisor. I mean, I had Alan Brinkley. And, I mean, you know, you can't ask for better than that in terms of establishment credentials. So, you know, I'm glad I did it. And once 1996 hit and I was living in a place called Fort Hall, I was doing great. I was this very happy time in my life. Okay. Let's see. I'm trying to remember a student named Barack Obama. No, I was there a little later than he was. Okay. Oh, that's nice. Studying economics at Columbia. That's nice. Okay. That's good. Well, okay, is there anything else rolling around here in your heads that you'd like to ask? You could do one or two more if you have anything. Otherwise, I won't keep you. Sorry, I'm kind of restless. I have been working in this chair. It's such a comfortable chair, and yet I've been in it so long today that it now feels uncomfortable. That has never happened before. What is the meaning of life? No, you should have asked, what is the ultimate answer to the ultimate question? Of course, we all know, what's the ultimate answer to the ultimate question? Extra credit if you know this. No, don't go yet. Extra credit if you know that. 42, thank you very much. All right. Yes, three people knew that. That is great. All right, well, so here's your assignment for those of you who didn't know this. You have to read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. That is absolutely so great. It is just such a great book, all the books in that series. I know, but what is the question? Now we have to build a whole new machine that will tell us what the question was. That is so great. All right, everybody, thanks for spending the time with me, and we'll see you next week. Yeah, I don't know. The answer is because we live in a deranged society. That's why. All right. Good night, everybody. We'll see you.